You're listening to the Mission Ridge Church Podcast. Mission Ridge is a new church in Missoula, Montana. You can visit us online at missionridge.church. Thanks for tuning in.
All right, good morning, everybody. How is Mission Ridge this morning? Excellent. I'm going to preach from down here. Is this okay? It's because everybody sits in the back. Nobody wants to be in the splash zone, like at SeaWorld. So first two rows. It's the way I preach, it can be a splash zone too, so it's probably a wise move, but I'm going to get closer to you guys by stepping down here. My name is Marty, like Paul said, Marty Solomon. I'm Jewish. Let's just get that out of the way. That's why I'm wearing these things. If I don't mention that, that's what will bug you the entire time. So there you go. I'm a Jewish follower of Jesus. We got that covered too, so we'll be okay there. I'm married. I've got two kids. They're the best part about me. I didn't bring them with me because it makes me look better when they're not around. Just kidding. My wife is amazing. My kids are wonderful. She actually called me yesterday and said, "We should have came with you." And I went, "Yeah, yeah, you should have. Why didn't we think about that?" So, mistake on my part, but... I'm the president of Impact Campus Ministries. I got into campus ministry kind of for backwards reasons. I didn't get into campus ministry because I had this big heart for the campus. I got into campus ministry because I was spending time in Israel and Turkey studying first century, more rabbinical Jewish approaches to discipleship. I came back and wanted to experiment with some of the ideas that I found there. I wanted to do discipleship a little bit using some of the methods that Jesus was using a couple thousand years ago. And the church didn't, and this isn't a critique of the church, but the church itself doesn't, we don't really have a place for that. Like, we don't know where to put that. We don't know how to fund that. And so I was coming back and trying to figure out how to make that work. And I was lamenting to God one day, like, God, I need a group of people that are like, they need to be adults, but they need to not be like, have mortgages and be married and all that stuff. And then it struck me like, college campus. That's where I ought to go do my work. So I spent 5 years in northern Idaho, where we're still at, Moscow, Idaho. We partnered with Real Life on the Palouse there, worked with college students, experimented with a lot of those discipleship stuff. Some of that stuff went really well and really enjoyed learning from that. And then they asked me to serve as president of the organization. So now I spend a lot more time on the road. We have 10 teams around the country, all doing campus ministry in different ways. In radically different settings. We have a team in Salt Lake City. We have a team in Tampa, Florida. So you can imagine the differences in culture, climate. We always do all-staff conference in the Florida locations. It's in January, so we never do all-staff conference in Salt Lake. But you get the idea. Being based here in Missoula, you understand that quite well, right? Winter is upon us. So, but enough about that. We're here to talk about Advent. You guys okay this morning? Yeah? Okay, good. Here to talk about Advent. Advent. What is Advent? Some of you may have grown up in more liturgical, because this is your first Advent. This is Mission Ridge's first Advent season. So some of you may not even know what Advent is, depending on what kind of world you've grown up in and what you're used to. Some of you may have had like a liturgical upbringing, and Advent is like a second language to you. And some of you might have been like, Advent, hey, I didn't grow up in the church at all, or I grew up in a church that never even observed Advent. What is Advent? Well, for thousands of years, God's people have always operated on some form of calendar. In the ancient world, in the Jewish world, you had the Levitical calendar, the calendar based on the books of Moses. And in the book of Leviticus, God gave you your holidays. I've always found these to be incredibly important because one of the things that communicates a narrative to particularly our children, but to us as well, one of the most important ways that reinforces a narrative is the holidays we observe. Like, if you think about it. Like, what's one of the most powerful ways that we communicate values? But through holidays. Whether it's 4th of July, Christmas, Thanksgiving. I'm not sure about Halloween, but you get the idea. Like, we communicate values to our kids through the holidays that we observe. I think God understood this, and in the book of Leviticus, he orchestrated two rounds of holidays around the seasonal experience of their world. In the biblical world, you had two seasons. You had a rainy season, and you had the planting season. The planting season was much longer than we're used to here in the Pacific Northwest. They had two seasons, not four. They had a rainy season that went from about November, December, through about February or March. And everything else was a planting season. In that planting season, they had two rounds, an early harvest, a spring harvest, and a late harvest called the fall harvest. And God put his two sets of holidays, three holidays in the spring, three holidays in the fall, and it all circulates around this experience you're all having about the harvest. It's an agricentric culture, meaning when you collect that harvest, everybody is full of anticipation, joy, celebration for the Lord's provision, and God syncs up his holidays with that same thing. What happens is 3,500 years later, when now you're living in a Christian world, largely a Gentile world, no longer centered on the region of Palestine in the Middle East, but now spread all over Europe in places like, eventually, Missoula, Montana, the holidays don't sync up the same way. Does that make sense? You don't have a spring harvest and a fall harvest. You have four distinct seasons. And so the Christian world eventually settled about 400 years after Christ. They started looking at their own calendar saying, how do we observe holidays that are more connected to our seasonal experience? And so we created two major seasons on our calendar, Advent and Resurrection, what we often call Easter. Advent being... If you guys understand this better than when I go to like Deep South or Bible Belt, Missoula's going to understand this and better. Everything around you is dying. It's getting cold. Like we're driven inside to sit around fires. The day is getting shorter and shorter. The sunrise is getting later and later. The sunset earlier and earlier. Everything about our world drives us in. To slow down, to sit around a fire, and to talk. Does anybody struggle with any kind of, you don't have to raise your hand, but seasonal affectiveness issues, disorders, any of that kind of stuff? You guys are killing me in the back row. We were joking about last night, preachers that make everybody raise their hands. So everybody raise your hand. No, I'm just kidding. Don't do that. But if you struggle with any of that seasonal affectiveness stuff, as everything gets overcast, as the sun goes away, Advent, these two seasons are, they make observations about the world around us. And then in the spring, everything comes back to life. And so what do we celebrate? Resurrection. Because Jesus comes back. You see what's happening there? And you're like, why has nobody pointed that out to me before? Yeah. Spring, we hook up our calendar observances to this natural seasonal. Advent is supposed to be this time where we draw in and we think about all the dark, dreary places in our life. All the places that are off. All the places that need to die. All the places that, which is where you'll stay until you get to Lent. Where does Lent start? With a day called Ash Wednesday, where we think about from dust we came into dust. You see, Advent brings us down. And you stay in this place until resurrection, and then you come out of it with a massive celebration of Easter. And so, Advent, the reason I think there's a dissonance in our culture with Christmas is because our culture doesn't do this, does it? In this massive, since the Industrial Revolution, since consumerism has taken off in the last century, we no longer do this pull in. Advent is, in our culture, Christmas time is big, loud, deck the halls, like Trans-Siberian Orchestra with all of our Christmas lights, like dun 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 dun. We all watch the Facebook videos because it's this huge Christmas is here. Jesus is coming. But that's not what Advent was designed to do. Advent was always designed to pull us in, to make us reflective. And so one of the things I think we experience in our churches is our churches will get caught up in this, let's catch the Christmas wave and let's just ride it in its bigness. And the whole time the Christmas story is calling us down into its smallness, because that's what the story of Christmas is. I think we run into this even when we read the prophecies. Because the first week of Advent is always on hope. The 4 weeks of Advent will always revolve around the same themes. First week is hope. Second week is peace. Third week is joy. Fourth week is love. And then the Christ child on Christmas Eve. These are the Advent celebrations. And this first week always opens with hope. And we always read the prophecies about Jesus coming and God sending us the Christ child. And sometimes we look at these prophecies and we go big and we say, Jesus is coming. But if you even look at the prophecies, it's hard to read the Bible in our American context. I'll put it that way. In the Jewish world, the Bible was always written by people who were under the boot of empire. It is difficult to be the empire and read your Bibles well. That is always going to be a challenge. And Christmas is one of those times where you see it drastically. You go to read the story of the prophets, and you want to read big, flashy, massive, lights, camera, action, like this kind of, and yet that's not what the prophets say. Let's go to this prophecy from Micah, one of the more famous ones. But you, O Beit Lachem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be a ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old and from ancient times. Let's leave this sitting right here for just a moment. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, we read this and we go, yes, out of Bethlehem, out of Beit Lachem will come a ruler. And we miss, though you are small. Listen, Bethlehem is a few hundred people large, maybe 2,000 by the most generous estimates. Okay, tell me what sounds more correct. But you, O Missoula, out of you will come a ruler. Or, but you, O Plains, Montana. Do you understand? See, we read this and we're so familiar with Bethlehem and the Christmas story, we think out of Bethlehem will come, but we don't catch the context. In their world, this was Plains, Montana. Out of you, O Plains, will come a ruler. And you can hear Bethlehem going, out of us? Out of little old us? You see, there were two cities of David. David was from Bethlehem. But David also landed in what great city? Jerusalem, also known as the city of David. So out of which city of David do you think the ruler is going to come from? You would think Jerusalem, and yet the prophecy says, out of you, O Bethlehem. And if you read the context of this, listen to the Footnotes podcast. We had a good time with that. We pulled this apart just a little bit. The context of this is a little, but this is the story of Christmas. I mean, the story of Christmas is a God who all of a sudden shows up, and he shows up to a young couple and says, you're going to be with child. This causes all kinds of problems, which we usually don't talk about in the Christmas narrative because we're so worried about the golden straw and chestnuts roasting on an open fire and feelings of eggnog and happiness that we never stop for a moment to go, wait a minute, they just got shamed and rejected by their community. They have to go home to Joseph's community, and when they get there, they're still rejected. I'll let Paul preach on the end sometime because there's no Motel 6 in Bethlehem. So what does Kataluma mean? There's no room in this guest room. Tell me you don't have room in your guest room for the pregnant lady. And so you're like, well, you can go hang out with the sheep. Like we dress the Christmas story up so much that we lose the wonder and the mystery of the Christmas story's smallness. And then the Christ child is born, and where do the birth announcements go? To all of Bethlehem, to Jerusalem and Judea. No, it goes to a few little shepherds watching their sheep. You see, the Advent story is a story about smallness. And when I say smallness, I don't mean insignificance. When I say small, I don't mean insignificant. In fact, its smallness, its accessibility is actually what makes it so significant. Because in fact, the bigness of the story, the kings, the government, the rulers, they're trying to find this smallness and squash it. Let's read the story from Matthew chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, at the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born king of the... They come where you would expect to come. The Magi go to Jerusalem, when it rose of it all. And like, where is this new king? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed. I would think so. King, you're talking to him. You're talking to the king. No, the new king. We've seen his star. What? Yeah. and all Jerusalem with them. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where Mashiach was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary. Now, just try to get the picture right in your mind. And there's a whole bunch of debate about the house and all that kind of stuff. Whatever you want to do with that. Here's this mother who gives birth in the sheep manure with no great care around her. Some shepherds get the birth announcement and they show up and you're like, this is just how I envisioned it. No. And now Magi show up. Can you imagine that scene? Like three wise men, kings, bearing gold, frankincense, and myrrh, showing up at whatever, a house, a stable, whatever the location is, looking around for the trumpets, looking around for the pomp, looking around for the bigness, nowhere to be found. They bowed down and worshiped him. They opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said to the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. You see, the Christmas story shows up. Oh, is there more? And Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi. He was furious. He gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. So you have this Christmas story about smallness, and the kings and the powers and the authorities of the world want to squash this new threat, but you can't find the smallness. It's not accessible to the bigness. The smallness is accessible to shepherds. The smallness is accessible to a rejected young couple who everybody thinks has had a child out of prior to their ceremony, shamed. The smallness, Advent hope is accessible to the smallness. It is inaccessible to the bigness. And so what does the bigness try to do? It tries to wipe it out by just, let's just kill all the babies in Bethlehem. I can't find the smallness, so we'll just do what we always do with big imperial. We'll just wipe it out in its bigness. This isn't the first time we've heard the story, is it? This isn't the first time we've heard a story of a king who's identified a new threat and decides he's just going to wipe out all the babies. The baby boys, even, to be more specific. Where have we heard this story before? Moses. It's almost like a retelling of God's great deliverance. Let's look at this story from Exodus. I believe Paul wants to use this for his Advent season, like he's going to walk us through parallels between the Exodus and the Advent story. So why not start here where the story begins? This isn't Christmas. This is the Passover. From a Jewish perspective, the great story of deliverance. Then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war, we'll get to more relevant material here in a moment, like material that actually relates to our world, where we would be looking at a world going, there's far too many of them. Never mind. Yeah, some of you are tracking with me. You're feeling okay. Yeah. This is what empire always does. And I'm not saying political, whatever. I'm just saying this is what empire always does. I don't know where you land on the arguments. I'm just saying. The bigness always looks at the smallness and says, squash the smallness because it's going to undo the bigness. Be careful of how fear works its way into your story. If war breaks out, they will join our enemies. They will fight against us and leave the country. A little bit later in the passage, we pick up, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah. I love that name, Puah. Say Puah. Everybody now say Puah. When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. The midwives answered Paro, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So God was kind to the midwives and the people. We're told earlier in the passage, the part that we skipped, that the midwives actually purposely don't show up in time. They have a conscience about them. And even though Pharaoh says, kill all the baby boys, they're like, oh, there's a birth going on? I'll hurry. And then they're like, I don't know, they're just so vigorous. They're having children before we can get there. Sorry, Pharaoh. Again, who is it that's changing the course of the story? The bigness or the smallness? A couple Egyptian midwives whose names are Shiphrah and Puah. And because the midwives feared God, what's Pharaoh's name, by the way? Who's the name of the Pharaoh? Oh, historians would love to figure that out, wouldn't we? He's nameless. The nameless Pharaoh, and yet two midwives who have names. You see what the story is doing here. There's significance in the smallness and not in the bigness. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Paro gave this order to all of his people, every Hebrew boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. This is the story of Christmas before Christmas. Christmas is a retelling of this ancient story. And I know that the Exodus story is going to be a big, flashy story. I get that. 10 plagues, the parting of a Red Sea. We've seen the Prince of Egypt movie, right? Like, I know that there's going to be bigness, but the real, like, mystery of the Exodus is not the bigness of the plagues and the parting of the Red Sea. The central piece to the Exodus story is what, or more appropriately, who? A little baby is sent into the middle of this story. His name is Moses. And this little baby is going to change everything. And it's going to be, I don't know why God chooses to work with people, but that's consistently what he chooses to do throughout history. He didn't need to. God could have done the Exodus from his throne. Like, he could have just sent the plague, spoke to Pharaoh himself, and yet he keeps insisting on working through this guy named Moses. Why? I think a massive part of that is a smallness and accessibility. What God will tell Moses is not, Moses, I have a message for you. God will tell Moses, quite literally, Moses, you have to go be the message. I'm not just giving you a message to go tell people. I need you to go be the message. Literal words in Exodus, you will be as God to Pharaoh. God could just deal with Pharaoh, and yet God says, Moses, I want you to go be God. I want you to go be me to Pharaoh so that Pharaoh can see face to face. There will be an accessible conversation to be had. What's the Christmas story? The story of a little baby entering the chaos and the mess, only this time it's not just a partner, it's God himself showing up to be accessible. One of my favorite Christmas songs says this. It says, my mind just went blank and I had this memorized. I have another song in my head and it's killing me right now. Prophets had foretold it, a mighty king would come. Planned from time eternal, God's anointed one. But the sovereign of all looked helpless and small as God gave the world his own son. The chorus goes on to say, who would have dreamed or ever foreseen that we could hold God in our hands? The giver of life was born in the night, revealing God's glorious plan to save the world. God's glorious plan. One of my other favorite songs, guy Chris Rice sung a song, talked about fragile fingers sent to heal us, tender brow prepared for thorn, tiny heart whose blood will save us. Have you ever considered the mystery of Advent, a little infant child being God wrapped in flesh, God trusting the bigness of his story to the smallness of us? That is Advent. One last song that I just love. The holidays always make me so nostalgic. This isn't who I typically am, but the poet in me comes out. One of my other favorite songs by Nicole Nordeman is a song called Small Enough. It's not a Christmas song, but I always listen to it at Christmas. It's on my Christmas playlist. Lyrics say this: "Oh, great God, be small enough to hear me now. There were times when I was crying from the dark of Daniel's den, and I have asked you once or twice if you would part the sea again, but tonight I do not need a fiery pillar in the sky. Just want to know you're going to hold me if I start to cry. All praise and all the honor be to the God of ancient mysteries, whose every sign and wonder tear the pages of our history. But tonight my heart is heavy, and I cannot keep from whispering this prayer. Are you there? And I know you could leave writing on the wall that's just for me, or send wisdom while I'm sleeping like in Solomon's sweet dreams. But I don't need the strength of Samson or a chariot in the end. I just want to know that you still know how many hairs are on my head. Oh, great God, be small enough to hear me now." I don't know if any of you are broken or suffering this Advent, but I know that most of us have been there. When you're in the middle of suffering and brokenness, is it really the bigness that you want? Or is it a God that would become small enough to enter even your story? Is it some news on CNN or MSNBC that you want to see God coming in the clouds when you're in deep suffering? Or do you want a God that shows up in your story and says, "I'm here to sit with you, to love you, to be with you"? Which God do we really want in our suffering? This is why the dissonance of Christmas in our culture robs us of the hope of Advent. Advent hope is always small. It's not big and flashy. And this is the opportunity we have to teach our kids about what real hope looks like. It's not in the gifts, it's not in the consumerism, it's not in the lights. Maybe all of that is great, and I'll let you wrestle with how to fit that into your Christmas. But Christmas is about a God who got small. A few implications before we head towards the Lord's table. Implication number one: God is bigger than our wildest comprehension, but he also became small enough to hold in our hand. It's not either or, it's most definitely a both and. God is certainly bigger than you could ever, I could ever, we could ever imagine corporately together. God is bigger than your bucket. God is bigger than anything you could ever dream up. He's bigger than that. And yet, all throughout the story, God keeps getting small enough to be accessible, small enough to step into our story, small enough. That's the mystery of God's story over and over again. Implication number two: this means that God is coming to you this Advent. Advent is not a season where, like, well, you know, Lent, you'll spend these 7 weeks in Lent, like, preparing yourself and fasting and reflecting and getting ready. This is a different kind of preparation Advent is. Advent is not a time where you got to get yourself all fixed up before you show up to God and all that. Advent is this time where God comes to you with all your doubts and all your questions and all your mistakes and all your sin and all your dirtiness and whatever your stable looks like. He comes in the middle of all the sheep manure and shows up and says, "I'm here." Before you get all dressed up, before you fix all your stuff, before you clear all the sin out of your life, Christmas is a story of a God who shows up and says, "I'm here." And not in like a judgment kind of way. I told this story in the Footnotes podcast. At the very, very end, somebody asked the question, "What is Christmas?" My daughter was born December 16th, 2008, right before Christmas. She was born 3 weeks early and spent a week in the NICU. And she got home before Christmas. But I remember that Advent changing everything for me because I stood in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, with my hands pressed up on the incubator, watching my daughter through the glass. Every 3 hours, we got to hold her for about 10 minutes. I got about three of those. And then she would have to go back and sit under these lights. Incredibly thankful for the technology, but I would sit with my hands pressed up against the incubator. I had no illusions that I could fix her problems. I knew that that was outside of my power, my expertise, and yet all I wanted to do was crawl in the incubator and hold her. The Christmas story is the story of God. When you get into the NICU, they make you put on these plastic gloves and this smock, and you have to be all sterile and stuff. The Christmas story is a God who rips off his smock and pulls off the plastic gloves, and he says, I'm going in. I'm not going in to fix the problem. I'm not going in to heal everything. I'm just going in to hold them. And in this case, let them hold me. It's the smallness of Advent. Implication number three, Advent hope looks like a person. Advent hope looks like a person, not a theological concept, not an announcement, not an idea. Advent hope looks like a person. It looked like Moses. It looked like Jesus. Even God became a person. So I wonder if in Missoula, Montana, Advent hope is going to look like people. I wonder if Advent hope in Missoula is going to have to look like you and me. It's going to have to look like us. Paul, can you spout off your vision one more time? Sounds like Advent hope to me. Advent hope probably isn't going to be in some billboard proclamation. It's going to be in a group of people that decide that Advent hope looks small enough that it's accessible because it looks like flesh and blood. That's our call. So we're going to move towards...
You've been listening to the Mission Ridge Church Podcast. Mission Ridge is a new church in Missoula, Montana. For more information about Mission Ridge, please visit us online at missionridge.church. If you are in the Missoula area, we would love to meet you. We hold service at the Hilton Garden Inn Conference Center on Sundays at 10:30 a.m. We would love to have you join us. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.